Okay, well, I want to welcome everyone to the Marine Interest Group of San Luis Obispo County. This group has been in active activities now for the last 5 years, since 2003, addressing the issues of coastal concerns here on the area of San Luis Obispo County, and a whole wide range of issues, from fishing issues to water quality issues to the marine life, the birds, and other concerns that are out there. And so this is a great forum for people to discuss those and to bring the concerns that they have about them and to work together to resolve them. My name is Don Marusk. I serve as the independent facilitator for the Marine Interest Group, so I'm pleased to welcome everybody. Just want to give a quick highlight for those people who are watching at home or seeing this on a video cast. We've got several topics we're going to be covering tonight. First, we're going to be having some discussion about the Alliance for Sustainable Fishing Communities, and have a presenter here, Steve Scheiblauer from Monterey, talking about the research that's been done on what are Californians and communities looking for from their local coastal communities, and how does that fit in the broader picture of fisheries. Then we're going to have a discussion about the marine debris concerns that were raised at the last meeting. We've got a group that's been looking at that, and Jill Falcone from the county is going to be talking about what she's doing at a county level to address that, and what are some initiatives that we can take locally if we choose. And then there'll be some discussion about oyster mariculture that Dan Berman and others will be discussing. And then a brief update about SLOSEA, which is the research effort to address all these different topics and figure out how to help get better information to make better decisions for this area. So a lot is happening. A lot's going to be under discussion tonight. We always start off with each of the members of the Marine Interest Group just introducing themselves and giving a one-minute update about things that are going on that they're aware of, that they think the community or their fellow members of the Marine Interest Group would like to know about. Just before I do that, I want to just acknowledge a couple guests that are here this evening. We've got Sally Kay, who's from Assemblymember Blakesley's office, and we're very pleased that the Assemblymember has an interest in these topics and that you're here this evening, and welcome your involvement. And we've got Mike Eng, who's the information coordinator for the southern area of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, picking up the position that Michelle Roost had. Remember Michelle from previous meetings of the Marine Interest Group? So Mike is picking up that role, and we welcome you this evening. So with that said, let's begin. I know that our supervisor for the coastal area here, Bruce Gibson, has to leave for a community advisory committee meeting shortly. Why don't we start with you, Bruce, and introduce yourself if you would, and then any quick updates of things that you know of going on that you think this group or the public would like to be aware of.
Thank you, Don. I am Bruce Gibson, 2nd District Supervisor for County San Luis Obispo, and I'm glad you didn't introduce me as a guest because I'm supposed to be here, and it's only because I have a conflicting meeting in Los Osos every fourth Thursday that I haven't been able to make it. Lots of things, and yet nothing particular. The county continues to work on a number of coastal issues. It's interesting. I have intersected almost everybody at the table one way or another outside this group, and trying to think what might be most pertinent to the group. I was interested to see the marine debris discussion. I do sit on the Integrated Waste Management Board, and just for everybody's information, the topic of possibly banning plastic bags in this county has come before that board.
Some financial stability for the Harbor District, give us some consistent income so that the next time the state comes knocking, we'll be able to take care of ourselves.
Great. Monica? And we welcome Monica. Monica is coming to us as a representative from the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo County. You remember Morgan Rafferty, the executive director of EcoSlow, had been representing that group previously, and she has asked Monica Hunter to take over as a representative from that group. I provided each of you on the committee with the two-page application, if you will, that Monica submitted. That's in accordance with the charter that was established for the Marine Interest Group, and the process for replacing members is having them address issues and questions, and so that's available for Monica. And we're delighted that Monica's here. She has many different roles that she plays. She's a member of the Regional Water Quality Control Board, which is very important for marine issues as well as land issues here. and has been very active in thinking about the connection between the land and the sea. So welcome, Monica. We're glad you're here, and I know you've had some recent activities, and maybe you'd like to give just a quick update on that as we go around.
Thank you. And I brought a handout to pass out just
Great.
To provide a little more information. We did hold our first meeting of Coast and Ocean Regional Roundtable 2009, and we did, in the last year that we conducted this, we did give you an update, and ECOSLO is our partner in this project, and so the idea that I would take on a fuller role here at the Marine Interest Group seemed to make a lot of sense, and I'm delighted that the ECOSLO board asked me to take on this role. We have a set of recommended actions that came out of our court meeting last March. Some of you attended that meeting. So this is a preliminary summary of the actual recommendations that the group developed, and this is our starting point for this coming year, and we hope to see some implementation of selected recommendations. There's a lot there to consider, but we're hoping that our process will allow for a diverse set of interests to engage in thinking about how we can further the coastal resource issues and help to establish a very strong marine presence for San Luis Obispo County. So I will look forward to working with the MIG on those issues as well.
Great. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Jeremiah O'Brien. Jeremiah, we missed you at the last meeting. I think you were out fishing. How has the season been, and what's an update from the fishing community?
Well, we were gone for, a lot of us were gone from Morro Bay here for the last 3.5 months or so. A lot of the boats are returning right now from the north coast of north, meaning Oregon and Washington. It was excellent albacore fishing this year. Excellent, meaning large number of fish. The grade of fish was good, large fish, and the price was good. So it's a strange combination to get lots of fish and a good price at the same time. The weather was not real good this summer up there, so it kept a lot of the smaller boats in, but most boats did very well. Currently off Morro Bay right now, from the areas from Point Conception to Point Sur, currently there's a lot of swordfish being caught, and hopefully we'll be out there in the morning ourselves, but the grade of those fish is also very, very large. And the last landings here in Morro Bay, I believe about, probably 6 boats landed fish here in the last 2 weeks. And the carcasses averaged between 220 and 240 pounds. So one boat would come in there, be 240-pound carcass, and the next boat there's 220. So it's pretty nice average. Anything over 200 is a good average, so they're very big fish. And we did want to briefly announce that the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization has recently given up its lease that we had from the city of Morro Bay for the last few years. We gave that lease up to Morro Bay Fish Company. We felt that if as everybody knows, we're a nonprofit organization, if a viable company put in an offer on the dock, we didn't feel it was our position to continue to hold that lease. So as of October 22nd, Morro Bay Fish Company has taken over the lease, and we wish them well. We hope everyone will support them. They will be operating the dock, unloading fish, buying and selling fish, and be operating the ice facility there also.
Really time, because we use the money with selling art at a silent auction, and there's music and food and all that, and we use the money that we raise, it's our biggest fundraiser, to fund our various programs, and one of them is water testing, and it will be brought up probably at some point tonight that, of course, there's been a cut to the county in regards to water testing, and we're hoping that we'll fill that void in some way, or get the funding back, or work in conjunction to do that, because it's the testing problem or the water quality doesn't go away just because we stop testing. And so we'd really like to continue that as much as possible. So maybe we'll see some of you guys out there. It's the sixth year we've done it, and it's always a fun event, and it's free to get into, one of the few. So that's
about it. All right, thanks. Mary Fullwood, who's representing the Sierra Club.
Hi. So I'm Mary Fullwood, and I'm the representative for the Sierra Club, and I'm also more broadly a representative for Surfrider for Los Osos. And since our last meeting, Chairman Patterson of the County Board of Supervisors requested that local environmental groups prepare an informational document analyzing the environmental benefits and impacts of the collection systems under consideration for Los Osos and include a recommendation for an environmentally preferred system, taking into consideration, for one, the proximity of the least tidal, to the least tidally active part of Morro Bay. The work product of Sierra Club, Surfrider, Slow Green Build, Los Osos Sustainability Group, the Terra Foundation, and the Northern Chumash Tribal Council is posted on the websites of Sierra Club, Surfrider, and Slow Green Build for anyone interested in reading it. Additionally, I attended the Regional Water Quality Control Board hearings for on the CMC regarding the raw sewage spill into the bay, as well as the chlorine releases, and Dan Berman was there as well.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Rick, do you have a report from the Morro Bay Harbor?
Maybe I should just defer, since our mayor's here, you just get me, Janice Peters.
Dan?
Good evening, I'm Dan Berman. I'm the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, and it's good to be here. Good to see you all. A couple updates on things we've been doing in the watershed. I guess to follow up on what Mary was saying, in addition to a sewage spill last winter, the wastewater treatment plant that discharges their effluent to Choro Creek has been having trouble since their new plant got finished with the chlorine disinfection process they use. And the result of that is that they use chlorine as the final stage, and then you need to take the chlorine back out because it's acutely toxic. And they've been having trouble getting that to work right all of the time, and so there's been numerous violations over the last year where they've discharged levels of chlorine to the creek that are acutely toxic. One of them resulted in a documented fish kill, although a number of the other ones may have also. There was not a follow-up on many of them because there wasn't a very good notification system being followed. So at the last regional board meeting, the regional board was considering this, and I spoke to it. A number of folks spoke to improving the notification system, reconsidering whether the minimum penalty was the appropriate penalty for a discharge of such a toxic substance to the creek, and then more broadly trying to figure out how we can get the problem resolved so it doesn't continue to happen. So all of that is sort of ongoing but important. On a more positive note, through a grant that we got from the Department of Fish and Game, we've been working this summer with a variety of folks, the Conservation Corps and Fish and Game staff, to try and bring down the number of the invasive fish, the Sacramento pike minnow, that's present in very high numbers in Choro Creek and is thought to be a serious factor limiting the abundance of steelhead. And as part of that, they've also been getting a better sense of what's in the creek. And in addition to getting rid of a lot of pike minnow, especially in some of the tributaries, they actually found much higher numbers of juvenile steelhead than had been documented in a long time. So that's encouraging news. Not sure if it's an increase in the population or if we're just finding out that they're there and we didn't know before. And then on the science front, we have completed our eelgrass map of eelgrass in the bay, which is really from last fall, and that's available on our website in a brief report format. And we did our first flush sampling because we've had a few small rains so far this year, and sampled the effluent running. I guess this year was just in Morro Bay, the effluent that runs off out of the storm drains during the first rain of the year, and it was sort of, as it has been in past years, pretty alarming in terms of levels of bacteria, turbidity and a number of metals, copper especially, which is primarily thought to be an automotive problem. It's in
provide drama.
Okay. Mayor Janice Peters from Morro Bay.
Hello. Well, depending on how you entered our city today, you went through our new roundabout, which we're kind of pleased with the results of that. It was a bit controversial, but it seems to be working out very well. And if you continue down Harbor, you passed our new fire station, which is going to be dedicated on November 15th. And then also we are very proud of the Harbor Walk, which I have mentioned before. It was an effort through SLOCOG and the Coastal Conservancy. And there is a possibility, depending on funding, that it will be continued to the north even farther. So we're really happy with that. There's a documentary being done here focusing on our local fishermen and the challenges that they're facing these days with all their restrictions and environmental concerns and trying to balance that with the economics and express their point of view on things. And that's being worked on by a nonprofit organization. She's coming back again. She was here a couple months earlier this month and coming back again next month. The Bird Festival is coming up again in January. You mentioned birds, and that's certainly part of our aquatic attraction, too. So if anyone's interested in participating in that, the brochures are now available online or at the Chamber of Commerce. And also I wanted to thank the Commercial Fishermen's Organization for the relationship that we did have on the dock for those years. You were a wonderful tenant and took very good care, and we appreciate that very much. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Dean Wendt from Cal Poly.
Hello, Dean Wendt from Cal Poly and the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, SLOCI. I'm going to be giving a brief update later. We've just finished our formal strategic planning process, which took many of you here participated in that process. It took a good 6 months, but the plan is written and has been submitted to various groups for hopefully to generate interest for funding the organization. I'll have some updates on that as well. And related to that, one of our current initiatives that I'll mention now is an initiative to demonstrate the framework and provide data to develop regional fisheries management. And along those lines, we've been collecting data as part of the baseline monitoring program for the Marine Life Protection Act that many people here are intimately familiar with. And we think that the data that we're collecting in that process can be used to inform management and to help build the knowledge base to have regional fisheries management here. But we just finished our second year of sampling in collaboration with the CPFV companies and also nearshore commercial trap fishermen. We spent 48 days fishing up and down the Central Coast in four different marine protected areas, those being Bouchon, Piedras Blancas, Point Lobos, and Año Nuevo. And this is a collaboration with the folks up north in the Monterey area at Moss Landing Marine Lab. So we're working with the fishing communities in each of our ports in these areas and trying to build the data that will, one, be able to help us determine whether or not the MPAs are functioning like we think they should be functioning, but then secondly, to begin to build the data that will allow us to understand the fish stocks to the degree that we could put forth a regional fisheries management model. So with that, I'll let Don take the meeting.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Dean. And Supervisor Gibson, since you have to leave before we're really going to get to the marine debris discussion and so on, I think it would be helpful just to inform that later discussion. Would it be of help to you and to the county if this group, after it learns more about what the county is contemplating and so on, to provide some input to you and to the other supervisors about what the marine interest group may perceive would be some options or some direction or
sure.
something of that nature?
Sure.
I'm just trying to think, since you won't be here for that conversation,
right.
what would you like to get from this group if the group chooses to offer anything around that topic?
You know, certainly a statement of the impacts of various sorts of marine debris. But, you know, again, let's go back specifically the issue First of all, the body is the Integrated Waste Management Authority of the county. That's a joint powers agreement between the county and the seven incorporated cities. It does have ordinance authority, so we've done ordinances mandating certain sorts of recycling that implement state law. Can't put batteries in landfills anymore, that sort of thing. But as other jurisdictions have contemplated the issue of plastic carryout bags, that issue is bubbling up in this region as well. And rather than take it on a jurisdiction.
So with that, we turn to our first major topic for this evening's discussion, which is about learning more with regard to what are some of the attitudes about coastal communities and about the use of coastal resources and about the role that fishing has had historically and contemporaneously in those communities. So we're very fortunate to have, through really Rick Algert's help, a presentation about that topic. And Rick, did you want to take just a minute to introduce the topic and then toss it to Steve?
You know, I don't think I'll introduce the subject other than maybe to introduce Steve, because he'll be making the presentation. I'm just taking up space tonight, apparently. Steve Scheiblauer was the harbor master in Santa Cruz Harbor for 20 years, and for the last 14 years he's worked as the same role in the city of Monterey. I've known Steve for 25, as long as I've been in the business. He's really an amazing person in this, in terms of knowledge and going back 35 years and what we do. A lot of us really look up to him. So I really appreciate the fact that Steve came down here tonight to make us a presentation first on the Alliance of Communities for Sustainable Fisheries and how they came about through funding from one of the local cable committee to have a professional survey done. And maybe, Steve, you could take over.
Boy, I sound really old.
Yeah. Well, you are.
There's the unit.
Well, very nice to be here. I appreciate the invitation and meeting some new folks, and hello to some old friends also. I want to spend just a moment to tell you about the group that has sponsored.
I want you to hold the mic. In order to pick all this up, you can have to speak into the microphone.
I want to take just a... I want to take just a moment to tell you about the group that sponsored the two studies that we're going to be talking about. That's the Alliance of Communities for Sustainable Fisheries. It was founded in 2000. It's currently a 501c3. It got that status about 3 years ago. It's a geographically based organization representing fishermen and communities from Port San Luis to Half Moon Bay. So there's basically six port communities that comprise it. It's organized with a board of directors, and there are regional representatives from the fishing communities in each of those ports who serve on the board of directors, and also a specific seat for representing the harbor communities. And also we tried outreach to recreational fishermen as well. There is a recreational representative on the board. And as you can see from the mission statement, can everybody read that? Okay. It's really a strongly science-based outfit that they try to really develop science and information products to bring to the public processes and to bring the forums just like this. And then the key thing, though, is that, to the best of my knowledge, it's the only organization on the West Coast that really actively tries to link fishermen with their communities and their communities with fishermen. The full circle. So fishermen are not just standing alone. Sorry. Okay. And you see the website below. And there's a lot of good information on that website. The two studies I'm going to be talking about are only a couple of about 10 or 12 studies and reports that are on that website under the report section. And we've done such things as provide a peer review of the socioeconomic products used in the MLPA South Central region. That was a peer review of the EcoTrust methodology, and done by PhD independent social scientists. And that was brought forward to the Fish and Game Commission. There is an extensive series of reports on the question of the need for additional MPAs within the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. trying to evaluate the need question from an ecological, a resource, socioeconomic perspectives. So there's a series of about, I think, eight or so reports there done by some of the best scientists on the West Coast. So, again, good source of information generally about resource issues and public opinion and what have you. So I'm going to go through the first poll just very briefly, actually both of them very briefly, because all the information about these polls is on the website, the full reports with the methodology statements. You can go look and see the whole narratives there. The first poll that was done actually a year and a half ago was April of 2007, right when the South Central MLPA process was just kind of wrapping up. Was a statistically valid poll, 805 or so Californians, every county of California was polled with a set of questions. And I've just selected that in coastal waters. Next is corporate commercial fishing companies listed as a, you know, high threat. As again, corporate. Naval and other military operations, I imagine the sonic, you know, stuff and other operations. Below that, wildlife viewers getting too close to marine mammals, marine species. And then down at the bottom, in terms of high levels of concern, family-run commercial fishing boats. So there's really not a very high level of concern amongst Californians about family-run fishing boats. And then below that, recreational fishing even a less of a concern. percent giving high ratings for the following. Highest rating, ensuring that California properly manages its coastal waters and coastal fisheries, 56. Next highest percentage at 37. Knowing that people have the opportunity to recreational fish in coastal waters in California regardless of whether they fish or not. The next at 34%. Knowing that fishermen can harvest fish sustainably from coastal waters in California. Next at 32, knowing that commercial fishermen can harvest fish sustainably from coastal waters in California. And below that also at 32, knowing that family-run commercial fishing boats can harvest fish sustainably from coastal waters in California. And then last, knowing that family-run fishing boats can harvest fish from coastal waters. This was summarized, you can see from the questions top, a series of questions that was asked in different ways about it. And you see the pretty substantial lumping between 37% and 29%, which is a fairly close lumping of, you know, wanting to know that fishing is sustainable is the main concept that you see there. Percentage who strongly or moderately agree with the following, and these are just asked to people who eat seafood. It matters to me that local seafood is harvested sustainably, 86%. If I knew that California currently has more conservation safeguards in place for its ocean fisheries than exist in other countries, I would buy California seafood over imported seafood. Very important question, and a very high level of support for that, 82%. Then at 79%, it matters to me that imported seafood is harvested sustainably. It's a good thing. Then falling way off, I would be willing to buy my seafood from international markets to put the highest priority on protecting California fisheries at 37%. So some element of the public just wants to see the ocean protected, and even if they have to eat all imported fish to do that. And then last, at 23%, I'd be willing to buy seafood from a source other than California, even knowing that many family-run commercial fishermen in California waters no longer will be able to make a living and would have to shut down their operations. So some feel so strongly about that value that they're even willing to suffer the loss of commercial fishing to fishing families. But again, as you can see, those are greatly minority positions. Which of the following positions do you think is better for California coastal fisheries? This is a very interesting question. First one, fully protect some areas from fishing, as in marine reserves, even if it means that fishermen will then concentrate their fishing in remaining open areas, which is inevitably true. If you close an area, the fishing doesn't just disappear. It usually goes someplace else. That's a 24%. And the alternative response, through the use of science-based limits on the amount of fish that can be taken, allow fishing in all areas. And that's at 68%. So by, you know, more than a 2-to-1 margin, people prefer to spread fishing out if it can be done sustainably as opposed to closing specific areas. And 8% didn't know. About 3% of California's ocean waters are already fully protected. That includes Channel Islands, meaning that no fishing or other extractive activities are allowed. Another portion of California ocean is closed to most fishing. These are the marine conservation areas like the RCA and the no trawl areas and what have you. Another portion, okay, and then the amount of fish can be taken elsewhere has also been reduced. That's the quota system that's in effect. If fishing restrictions are increased, family-run commercial fishing boats may go out of business. Knowing this, do you support or oppose adding to the restricted areas in the ocean waters in California, or do you not know? Strongly support, 11%. Moderately support, 16%. So there you've got 27%. Moderately oppose, 18%. Strongly oppose, 20%. So there you've got 38% who would oppose adding even more. Work to keep this type of opportunity available for the public. And 58% strongly agree, and 26% moderately agree to that. So high level of support for those party boat opportunities. And that is an industry, in my experience, that's been very, very hard hit by regulations and MPAs and what have you. So in my case in Monterey, we had 14 commercial party boats in 1995, and now we're down to 5 with one business for sale and no owners coming up. So that's really having quite an impact. And another very interesting question. When you think of the term commercial fishing as it applies to California, do you think primarily of large foreign factory ships, large U.S. corporations, or small family-run fishing boats? So you can see very high correlation of people thinking about commercial fishing as equaling large foreign factory ships and large U.S. corporations, even though that is not the profile of commercial fishing in California at all. It's almost entirely small family-run businesses. So, again, this poll was 800 Californians at random, just, you know, what people think based on what they know. So I was going to move on now to the, unless you have questions you want to ask me about this one, I was going to move to the other one on tourism and fishing. Dean.
So the 800 people surveyed, they didn't live in coastal communities necessarily. They just lived anywhere in California. Is that right?
They were picked at random in each county of the state, I think based proportionally on population of the county.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The methodology statement is available in the,
mm-hmm.
on the website.
I'm not questioning. I was just wondering if these were just the knowledge base of the individuals that were answering. I mean, how close they live to the ocean and how much they interact with fishing communities versus being completely separate from them.
Yeah, that's always the key with a poll. And, of course, that's always the difficulty or art of polling is, you know, how much information do you give? How neutral is it in the polling questions?
Right.
And a good poll would inform along with query, typically.
So what are your sort of take-home messages from that poll?
Well, to me, it's, you know, the public strongly values sustainability as a value and it does not necessarily want to see the public not able to use areas of the ocean or the ocean as a whole. The public has a wrong idea about what commercial fishing is in California. So maybe there's some education that needs to happen there. And you know, the one on, I think that the support, and this might be really controversial, you know, in any group, but I think the direction that the state is going with the marine protected areas and how rapidly and how much they seem to really want them may not really link up with the attitudes of the general public. And it may very well link up with attitudes
of people who are more closely aligned right at the coast.
Right.
Okay, but talking about all of Californians, for that matter, all of the United States, it may not be there.
I was interested, and I'm not quite sure that I understood it correctly. I think I did. They were talking, one of the questions was about would you buy fish from other countries to protect this area? And that seems so hypocritical that, yeah, we'd go to a country that doesn't have any protections and buy the fish from there to protect our fish, which seems strange. Was that actually what came out of the survey, or did I misunderstand that?
It was... not a majority of respondents felt that way,
but quite a bit.
I think it was 30% or so that thought that way. And that does go to the question that has been asked often in fishery management generally and also in the MPA setting, of that if you really kind of wipe out fishing here in California, wipe out the infrastructure and those kind of things, and then you start, therefore, needing to import, because the public is going to consume seafood. It's, you know, very
right,
high.
Right.
As you'll see in the letter, one, very high desire to do that. And so they're going to consume this imported seafood. And what are the fishing practices in those areas? And since we're one of the most, if not the most, highly regulated, fishing areas, west coast of the U.S., and, you know, you're talking about, you know, the fisheries of Korea and Southeast Asia, Russia, Mexicans and the Canadians, what have you. So you really don't know what you're doing to those resources, and it leaves the question, are we essentially exporting and protecting our resources, exporting our impacts?
Well, when you got to the last thing about the perception of what commercial fishing is, and I'm wondering if maybe those two are linked, that they think it's all these big corporations that are just raping the ocean anyway. So
factory versus family. You know, in our corporate versus family here in California, have you seen any data like that?
I haven't seen.
I know in Morro Bay.
A hard sure. data source. Mm-hmm. You know, I can certainly myself have a mental panorama of all the boats in the harbors between San Francisco and even including Santa Barbara.
I'm
pretty familiar with those fleets, and they're not there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no factory
right.
boats there. They're. You know, years ago, you had the tuna fleet out of San Diego when you had the canneries there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but they haven't. They've been offshore for 20 years
mm-hmm.
or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is all, and also brings to mind global climate change, you know, and to move fish around the world doesn't make a lot of sense from that perspective as well.
Well, it also goes to the question, though, what happens if we lose our fishing infrastructure to the point that we're now dependent?
Right.
We have no infrastructure. We're dependent on other countries for a food source.
Sure.
You know, we're dependent on oil.
Yeah.
So it bothers me. Okay, keep this going here. Yes.
Do you have specifics on what the it just felt like it went too quick, the threats to the marine coast, the 72% said water pollution in the ocean and coastal waters. And do you have an elaboration on what was seen as the pollutions? Was it stormwater runoff? Or
I don't think the poll got to that detail. No,
okay.
I don't. But you can certainly look at the whole thing on the website. But I don't recall that there were any more detail. Yeah, localized.
Okay.
Okay.
May I also comment on... Hi, Steve. Monica Hunter.
Yeah.
You mentioned loss support infrastructure and what that might do in terms of the long-term capacity to maintain California's fisheries. Is this on? Am I on? Okay. There's also a consideration, especially for rural areas, where there are linkages and there are social implications for communities where seasonal fishing, labor support, and some of the technical support, buyers and marketing networks and so forth, these are also linked more broadly beyond just local geographic areas. There are links into the ag industry and community. They have similar support allied industries, allied services, and so these linkages have to be considered as well, because the impacts will have a broader fallout. They're not as directly viewed right now, and we don't have a good assessment of the fishery economy and the fishery as a system statewide or even on a regional scale. But I think considering in rural areas, especially like this, where we have really selected economies that have been traditionally based in smaller areas, ag and fishing being linked in various ways that we don't fully understand yet. But that certainly is another impact that could occur.
Yeah, Monica, you're absolutely right. And the buy fresh, buy local, I mean, fishermen are natural partners with the ag community on that development of that as a societal value. And, in terms of partnerships, tomorrow Rick is coming up with a couple of members of Morro Bay City Council, and we're going to meet with a couple of members of Monterey City Council, and we're talking about how do we preserve the culture and heritage and economic contributions of fishing in our communities. And it's the second of some slated meetings that are going on. So, you know, we are actively working on these questions, and the situation is dire, as Jeremiah knows and Rick knows. Henry.
Briefly, clarify in terms of imports, a question of scale. In 2007, the U.S. imported $13 billion in seafood. And our largest seafood importing partners are Canada is number one, China is number two, and then Chile and Indonesia are number three and four. It falls off pretty quickly after that, $13 billion in imports. We import 80%.
What was domestic production?
I don't have that number off the top of my head.
In California, it's in the about 200 million range, I believe.
Oh, four billion.
Yeah.
4 billion for the country.
Yeah. The percentage, if you don't mind if I break in there, the percentage is approximately 85% import, 15% domestic.
Oh, I was just going to say the thing that strikes me the most, and this is kind of following up out of that, is this buy fresh, buy local, and just the level of education that's needed. Because I mean, you had people willing to, you know, people volunteering, you know, prompted by the question to buy fish from overseas if it meant being more sustainable, when in fact the opposite is the case, as Janice said. But I think people really don't realize that and don't understand this idea and raise people's awareness that buying California caught fish is a good thing for the oceans as a whole.
Thank you. So moving right along here, the second poll we did more recently was finished, I think, in June. And it was done in two parts. One part queried community leaders and business leaders, tourism business leaders, in three California communities. And that's Morro Bay, Monterey, and Crescent City. And the question for those business and civic leaders was their assessment as to the importance of fishing activities and fresh local seafood to the success of their tourism economies, with the emphasis on tourism economy. And the second part of it was going to visitors, and it polled 320 or so visitors to these communities, asking them, why do you come, basically, and putting some option choices and trying to assess how important going to seafood restaurants, knowing it's fresh local seafood, knowing that it's caught sustainably, how important is that, is along with, you know, visiting the waterfronts and seeing the boats and everything. And the reason that we did this was primarily, again, the Marine Life Protection Act, that there was really absolutely no information developed in the South Central region. I don't think it was developed in the North Central either, about the impacts to communities, you know, if fishermen went out of business or had impacts or were struggling. You know, what did it mean to the communities in particular? And basically, you know, the linkage, as you'll see, is that if you hurt fishing in these communities, you'll hurt tourism. That's the basic conclusion. So moving right ahead here. That looks familiar. Okay, methodology statement, you probably all read that. We would have liked to have had more visitors polled, but it was remarkably difficult to get information out of at least some of the communities, not Morro Bay, but some of the communities, to get that visitor information out of the chambers of commerce and what have you. So we kind of did the best we could. It's considered to be statistically valid, but still I would have liked to have probably double that number if we could have. Can you all read that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to read everything then. So as I said, basically, you know, pretty high, pretty strong levels of appreciation on the part of civic and business leaders about fishing culture, heritage in their communities. I want to say right now, you're seeing also site-specific landmarks and wildlife and the bays and beaches. I want to make sure you know what this study is not, which is it wasn't designed to be a comparative study of, like, in Monterey, would you rather go to the aquarium or would you rather eat fresh seafood? And it wasn't doing that at all. And you could do that kind of study, and that would probably be valuable for, you know, tourism professionals and stuff, but that wasn't what this was doing. It was just trying to assess the importance of fishing activities. This is just a mean average, you know, a scale of 1 to 10 with local history in Monterey, my community. That's a very strong thing, you know, beyond fishing. It's, you know, all the California history part of that. You know, very high numbers for commercial and recreational activities. Okay, then we get to the interesting stuff of comparison of the communities. And we'll go through this, but I'll give you just an opinion off the top here that there's some big differences between Crescent City and everybody else on this. And I kind of think part of that, I mean, Crescent City is very dependent on fishing and their economy. Very, very dependent. But it's run by a harbor district, which is not the same thing as in city government. And I think, you know, for the tourists going down 101 and what have you, they're just not quite as connected to the harbor there as they are where in Morro Bay, the waterfront is all along your esplanade. It's just there. In Monterey, it's right downtown also. That may be the difference, why there's some differences. It could also be as simple as there, with all due respect, there may not be any good seafood restaurants in Crescent City. May not be as many good restaurants.
Not particularly a tourist destination.
Not really. It is for a few, but mostly it's a travel-through location.
It's windy.
Okay, so, you know, you can see that Morro Bay here in red has pretty high readings. Okay, factors. Okay, by far and away in these small communities, tourism is the big economic engine. Great importance in attracting business to their community. Majority, 74%, having local fresh seafood available is of great importance in attracting business to the communities. Okay, this brochure thing is interesting because I kind of have long observed when we talk about these things that if you, at least in Monterey, if you look at any brochure out of a hotel or in the info booth or the chamber, it's got two kinds of pictures on there. It's got a picture of a whale or an otter, and it's got a picture of a commercial fishing boat. They all do. And that really kind of says it all. That looks familiar too. Okay, guys, go over that. I think I know that guy. Okay, so now we're on to the visitor part of it. Seven factors. They all place great importance in being able to access the ocean, access the beach, and be able to get to isolated and crowded coastal areas. Seeing wildlife is very important to visitors. No surprise to me. And then Monterey and Morro Bay, there also is a great emphasis on what they call one human cultural item, which is restaurants. You know, that seems to be a very big reason that people go to particular communities is the kinds of restaurants that they have in those communities.
Okay, so again, scaled out to per city, and pretty much the seven things that I mentioned already. Being able to get fresh local seafood down there, very high. Being able to go to restaurants, very high. 91% in Morro Bay, 92% in Monterey. Motivations for visiting. And we'll get to the choices they have, but the top rated item, a community's culture, such as its identity as a fishing village, is worth preserving. And, you know, that's something I think is, you know, profoundly true. That people want to go away from places like L.A. or whatever, Fresno. They want to come here to something different and see what's been preserved. And I know in Monterey, our commercial fish offloading wharf, wharf number two, when we have fish being unloaded, it's wildly popular with tourists, foreign tourists and American, the tink and pitchers and the seagulls are dropping stuff on them, and they love it. They absolutely love it. Yeah, it's a big hit. Okay, overwhelming majorities went to a restaurant while there. Okay, and a large majority ate seafood.
Steve, I think that, I mean, we can see this, but I think the people at home, because there are people at home watching, or will watch, some of them, they can't see quite as well as we can.
Okay.
It's on those graphs. If you could just, I think it'll help the people. For us, it's great, but there, I think a lot of people will watch.
Okay, I kind of forgot about that part of your thing, so okay. Importance of restaurants and visiting coastal communities. 92% and 91%, Monterey and Morro Bay, respectively. Being able to go to a good restaurant was somewhat or very important in the decision to visit those communities. Majorities of visitors seek out restaurants in the communities, specifically for seafood. 74% in Monterey, 79% in Morro Bay come here for seafood. Okay. And the statement to agree with or not agree with, sometimes I seek out restaurants specifically for seafood in Monterey and the communities. And do you agree or disagree? So strongly agree, 51% in Morro Bay, 42% in Monterey. Moderately agree, 32% in Monterey, 28%. So the aggregate of those is pretty high. And not too many people disagree with that. And here's the one that made me wonder about the good restaurants in Crescent City. The 25% down there sticking out. Yeah. Hope I don't get in trouble with Crescent City.
Morro Bay gets good grades there.
Yeah. Okay, eight factors in deciding whether to go to a restaurant in the three communities. Four of them relate to the types of food, remaining items or cost, and the fishery itself, and local fishing fleets selections, and neither is vegetarian or ethnic foods. Survey folks were asked questions about seafood consumption, and the results were ranked. The top ranked statement for all three communities is, it is important that seafood is not harvested in a way that endangers the fishery itself. I like that.
Yeah.
Majorities agree with most of the statements, and there was not much difference between the top-ranked statement and the lowest-ranked statement.
So can you just clarify something for me on that?
Yes.
When it says endanger the fishery, how is that, just for clarification, different than endangering the fish? Can you just make that distinction for people? I think that.
Well,
is there a distinction?
Think to me, it was meant to be one and the same thing.
Okay, good. That's
it's
all.
It's linked to the sustainability question.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
I don't think the Republic responding, to this was that sophisticated. Okay. Let's see. I think I've gone through most of this stuff already. Respondents with very high values that they're concerned about the fishery and the way fish are caught, concerned about that it be local. I would be more likely to go to a community where I could get fresh local seafood than a coastal community where I could not get fresh local seafood. That's a very important question. Distinguishing yourself from, I'm not sure what other communities that don't have ports or harbors or access to fresh fish, but very high values, 72% in Morro Bay, and Monterey rather, 79% in Morro Bay. When I go to Monterey and Morro Bay, I like seeing the fishing boats. Here in Morro Bay, very high value, 88%, and in Monterey, 76%. When I go to Monterey or Morro Bay, I like seeing the waterfront activities. I like to watch seafood being unloaded, which is my earlier remark. And very high value here in Morro Bay again, 81. And sometimes I seek out restaurants specifically for seafood in these communities. Here in Morro Bay, it's 79%. Waterfronts. Overwhelming majority of visitors visited the waterfronts. 80% in Crescent City, 93%, and 97% in Morro Bay. And again, I think that may be the Crescent City difference may be with how it's laid out in relation to the rest of the community. Visitors to Monterey and Morro Bay more often said that being able to visit a working waterfront with a commercial fleet was important in their decision to visit the communities. Now, that's also goes to the question I said, that we didn't try to compare that with what is it more important to do that or to go to the aquarium or to go to or to see the rock or get away from the heat in Fresno or, you know, whatever. And so that this slide kind of parses that out a little bit more. But about being able to visit a working waterfront with a commercial fleet, how important. And in percentages, the totals there you see for Monterey, it's somewhat or very important to 46% in Monterey, 62% here in Morro Bay. And the unimportant numbers are pretty low for Monterey and Morro Bay, the somewhat unimportant and very unimportant, pretty small percentages. Okay, there were two questions relative to visiting restaurants. Large majorities of visitors to three communities think it is important to know that the seafood being served is fished in a way that does not endanger the fishery itself. 79% in Monterey, 75% in Morro Bay. Additionally, very large majorities think it is important to know that the seafood is caught by local fishermen. 79% here in Monterey, 81% in Morro Bay. And again, parsing it out by community, you can see the differences there. And the people who thought it was unimportant were quite small numbers, 7% and 5% respectively for somewhat and very unimportant. Okay, what about knowing that seafood is caught by local fishermen? Inexpensive way for those who do not own a boat to get out on the water. We asked the same question basically in this study as we did in the other one about the value of the charter fleet. So again, on the charter fleet, high percentages who value it. Okay, so this wraps it up. This is just a little thing about responsive management. This is also on our website, so you can see their website down there. And Mark Duda, who's the owner and manager of the company, has been in business for about 25 years, I think. He welcomes phone calls about methodology or other details of the study. So If you really want to get into the study, you can give him a call. And that looks familiar to me. That's Fisherman's Wharf in Monterey. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
So,
questions that you might have of Steve and of this survey effort? This is in response, you recall, to the concerns and interests that the Marine Interest Group had at its last meeting about what's happening with regard to the fishing communities up and down the coast and how are they perceived and so on. So this was an effort to provide some data and some information for your consideration about that. And anyone have anything they'd like to clarify from what he presented? Monica?
Actually, I have a question as to how this study will play into current efforts to fashion a sustainable policies for sustainable fishing for California. And considering that we have so little socioeconomic information on the fisheries where we can really consider and be informed by, you know, a broader set of impacts, what's it really at stake, it looks like there's some good information here in terms of public sentiment and public perception, not only for educating people in terms of misperceptions, you know, big factory trawlers, corporate level fishing, but also in terms of educating our elected officials and leadership in the policy arena to consider. I think you've done a really good job at defining and breaking out some of the issues more carefully than we've seen in other studies and other surveys that have really carried the day in terms of, you know, how popular the popular support for ocean protection and marine resource protection. So it'd be interesting to see how this information gets worked into that process and, you know, how effective can it be in the long run.
Yes, this study and the other one have been quoted in several news articles about particularly the MLPA process. Coincidentally, Rick and I both belong to the California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference. It's a 60-year-old organization of California ports and harbors, and the executive director of that is going to be on a panel for the ocean, the governor's three West Coast governors' ocean plan. It's going to be a panel next week where he's been provided this information, and this topic is how do we have sustainable coastal communities. And so we're hoping that this very information can come out in that form, which should be a high-level discussion. One reason we did Crescent City in this was because they will eventually be subject to the MLPA when it gets up to them, and to give them something to say about this that otherwise probably won't be developed by the MLPA process. And some of these, you know, the questions of, like, the what do you mean by protection when you say you want to protect the ocean? I mean, that's just a classic question that can be used in many, many forums to really get at the heart of what the public wants. So we do hope to put these studies to good use and continuing use. Can I remark that another genesis of the study was an ongoing dialogue in my city, and maybe it's the same here in Morbay, I don't know, but my finance people who were constantly bugging me about how expensive it is to maintain the wharves. And, you know, does the fishing community pay enough for it? And can't we just raise the rent? Or shouldn't we replace, you know, the port infrastructure, the buildings with T-shirt factories or restaurants and make more money? I mean, they're not city council people and they're not policymakers, but the money people, you know, have these questions. And so I have long said to them that they need to think about fishing as either a loss leader, that it, you may spend more money on one hand, but you're bringing people here and they're spending money in other ways, which I think is exactly what you see in the study, to try to think of it more broadly. So that was another motivation to try to put a little more science, if you will, to the question of how fishing and the tourism, the greater tourism economy relate. And I'm sure it's true in Morbay that tourism is, you know, the really big engine.
For the excellent presentation, and thanks very much to the Alliance of Communities for Sustainable Fisheries for all the work that they do. And I sure hope people appreciate that that our harbor managers and harbor masters work. You know, a lot of people probably think your jobs are just making sure boats get tied up or everybody pays their slip fees or something. But that you guys work and put a brutal amount of effort into all of the things that it takes to maintain the health of the ports that you're in charge of. And it goes well beyond, as I said, just to tie up a boater. It goes into the commercial fishing, into all of the economics that it takes to keep these ports and harbors running. These guys do an incredible job. I just want to say thanks a lot for the presentation, Steve.
Well, can I say something real quick, and Dan, I'll...
I want to say something, too.
Are you? Okay. Well, I just wanted to, it's going to end up with a question, but real quickly, I'm going to pick up on that. And there's probably some folks at home that are thinking, or if you're a surfer, you're thinking, well, I know that those kind of values are just as high if you asked about ocean recreation. You know, you mentioned that this is not a comparative study. In no way do we intend to diminish the value of ecotourism or the value of surfing or kayaking, which are really seen growing. Tell us why you asked this question, and maybe, you know, why did we do this poll? Why did you do this poll, the Alliance?
Well, because you know, what I'm seeing is a near collapse of fishing infrastructure in these small coast communities, Morro Bay, Monterey, what have you. I mean, it's a daily struggle to keep these guys in business. And, you know, for Monterey, you know, it relates so much to the Sicilian community we have in Monterey, also the immigrant community who came over as fishermen. And, you know, people still run for mayor in Monterey saying, oh, my father or my grandfather was a fisherman. So it's just very much part of the fabric. And I'm watching it go away. The city council is watching it go away. And the level of concern has just risen to the point where, you know, they're being supportive of these kind of efforts and this dialogue I mentioned before between Morro Bay and Monterey, which I predict will expand to other communities, because I think a lot of other communities are facing the same thing. This, if you don't know, there's about 20% the number of commercial fishermen now than there was in the mid-1980s. And there are very few young commercial fishermen.
I think the thing that impressed me, and it's not surprising to me because I think we've been dealing with it here in Morro Bay, obviously from the survey results, but the fact that the appreciation for the fishing industry itself, the fishing boats, the actual work of the industry is one of the attractions. It's not just the result of it. It's not just the fresh seafood, but it's the whole process. It's very historical. People really relate to it. And that's something that I think has to be recognized. It's not a matter of protecting the ocean to the removal of fishing. I think fishing is something that our population very much appreciates. And that's something we have to keep in mind. It's not just the eating the fish. It's the whole process of it being caught here. It's the industry of it and its part in our history.
I'm going to defer to Dan because he's been wanting to speak. So go ahead, and then I'll
jump on it too.
Well, I was going to say, you know, there's lots of disheartening news about the state of the fishing industry, but I think both studies had really encouraging things to say, I think, about both the whole population of California and then visitors to the coast. You know, overwhelming desire both for sustainable fishing, you know, in every sense of the word, and an appreciation for commercial fisheries at the small business level. And it strikes me that I know it's an incredibly difficult issue, but the issue of, I mean, everyone says they want to eat sustainable fish, but there's no way to know. I mean, there's a plethora of efforts out there from all kinds of different institutions to try and figure out how do we make it easy to find out, should I be eating this fish? Is this, was, you know, you can ask if it's local, and a lot of times you don't even get a straight answer to that in restaurants. I mean, even in coastal towns. But then, if you ask your server if the fish was, is this a sustainable fishery? I mean, it's not defined. And I think it shows that it's a very difficult issue, but it strikes me that it would be hugely in the interests of fishermen to help develop a clear, single approach. You know, I don't have any solution to doing it, but it seems like people want to buy sustainable fish, and we need to make it easy for them to make that decision, because if they had that, you know, if it was on the label, and I guess this is a simpler example, but I think of my understanding of what's happened with salmon.
You're on, just Steve. Ireland has a process in which they identify their fish as sustainable or so forth, the label, if you will. Europe has various labels, European Union. Iceland does, Norway does, Japan does. Our efforts to get our government to do this have been unsuccessful. And it's a tragedy, but we just can't get them to do it. But by and large, all of the fish in the United States are caught in a sustainable fashion. We have the toughest rules and regulations in the world.
Well, on the West Coast.
In the world today.
On the West Coast.
On the East Coast, the West Coast, the Gulf, the United States of America has the toughest rules and regulations in the world.
Yeah.
So by and large, if you are buying something that was caught and processed in the United States, American caught, it's more than likely sustainable. I don't want to say there's probably one or two problems, but National Marine Fisheries does not allow, nor NOAA, allow us to catch, or there's nothing I can think of that is caught in an unsustainable fashion.
Henry?
Yeah, just also along with that regulatory perspective is the compliance perspective. The U.S. fishermen are some of the most compliant in the world as well, and the whole system of owning a boat and having insurance and having a permit and landing fish is linked, and the rules are enforced and they're universal, and that's an important part of the whole argument as well, or discussion as well.
Okay, my final.
No, I deferred to Dan. I didn't mean to give up my ability to say something. That's unlike me.
Professor Wendt, go ahead.
Yeah, right, there you go. No, I think that I enjoyed listening to what you had to say, Steve, and I think it's clear from your data that Californians want what's good for Morro Bay, and they want what's good for our fishing community and our fishing families. I'm wondering, this whole notion of protection, did you guys ever use the term preservation in the survey? Because I think that's the big distinction. Protection, I think, connotes sort of sustainable use, whereas preservation means you're not touching it. Did you guys ever explore that term at all?
No, but it was inherent in the answer,
uh-huh.
the choice they had, because
right.
One choice was a preservation answer,
right,
and the other choice was a sustainability or conservation or protection
mm-hmm.
answer.
Okay.
But I agree, there's important nuances between the use of these words.
So two more quick questions. One is, why didn't you guys include a Southern California community?
Why didn't we?
Yeah.
Because,
I don't mean Santa Barbara. I mean a Southern California community. I mean, the MLPA is running down there now. And it must look different.
Yeah, it would look different.
Yeah.
It would look different, yeah. And I guess in my mind, for my two cents of it, and I wasn't the only decision maker on this, but I wasn't thinking that there were communities that had such distinct identities,
right,
and historical.
And that would have been the neat reference, because we know those communities don't have that identity anymore, and it could give us an idea of what's lost when that disappears.
We also only have so much money.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And then finally, I'm going to push you a little bit, because you know, in ecology, we always talk about an appropriate baseline is what you need. If you want to make an inference about how things have changed, you have to have a good baseline. You guys have heard that. You've heard it numerous times. So you made a comment that in the 1980s, there were 20%. We have 20% the activity or fishing levels that we did
right.
Now compared to 1980. What happens if we go to 1960? What does that look like? I've not heard people talk about that, and I just...
Well, I think the number's smaller again. I mean, I can tell you from my...
I know, but what is... Do we know what that curve looks like? Are we now, you know... Where are we relative to we talk about a history and a culture and so on and so forth. And so I just, same with ecological data, I'd like to know what it looks like when we go back more generations than the 1980s, which is still a long time ago. I mean,
that's a great question. And, and it would, you know, the answer would go to how the U.S. deliberately capitalized the fleet. I mean, the part of what the Magnuson Act is about was was getting our fisheries going. That didn't really occur in the 60s or 50s. I mean, it did to some degree, but not like the boom that happened in the between after 76.
But I would say that the Morro Bay identity extends beyond the 1980s. I mean, we...
Yeah, as a kid, I bought abalone here. It was an abalone port.
Right. Anyway, that would be interesting to know. I don't know what the
value that's come forward. And you're also going to want to know, or need to know, that if you hurt the fishing economy, you hurt the tourism economy of these communities. So, thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for taking your personal time and effort to come down and do this. Really appreciate you making the presentation. Just one kind of final looping note about this topic. One of the things that struck me about the data that we received from Steve here is that, as Dean alluded, one of the initiatives for Slow Sea, the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, is to look at how can there be the opportunity to create both sustainable fish populations and sustainable fishing communities. And that initiative, I think, is really powered in part by the appreciation of what is the role, what is the importance to the public of this. Because as we go to the Ocean Protection Council and others to get funding for this, they sort of say, well, you know, why put a whole lot of effort into a community like Morro Bay for this? What's in it for the state? Yeah, it's nice for Morro Bay, but what's in it for the state? And I think the data that you're sharing is the people who come from all over the state and beyond come and value that experience, that resource. And so there is a spillover effect that's greater than just what the dollar value is of the fish being caught and the experience that's happening in this particular area. So appreciate your data and information. And thanks, Rick, for helping to organize this. Appreciate it. So we're going to move on to our next topic here, which is a topic about marine debris. That was a key issue that was brought up at the last marine interest group meeting, and one that we wanted to be sure to be addressing here this evening. And Matt, would you like to just kick that off and just in terms of, you know, the genesis of this, and introduce Jill for our audience, and I'll get her PowerPoint cooking here.
Okay. Well, this has been brought up at other meetings we've had about the other issues that the MIG might look at and support, or at least hear about and get more educated on, and thereby also educate the public through the televised broadcast. And one of them that came up again and again among many of us was marine debris, plastic bags, all the things that stick around way too long in our ocean and remind us that of how much we pollute it. Wherever you go in the world, on a Fijian island, you can sit there on a beach that's never been touched by human feet and have a plastic bag wash up. And that, just for the aesthetic aspects, changes everything, but obviously also for the environmental and health aspects. So I'd looked around the county and along with Mary and PJ Webb, and we had talked about who we might have come talk and what was going on in regards to those types of issues. And so this is just maybe one little perspective on it and one topic. When Jill and I were talking about what she would talk about, it was like, okay, well, how big do we make it? Do we just stick with the plastic bag kind of ordinance that Bruce Gibson referred to earlier? Or do we go beyond that and talk about, obviously, all the other issues of plastics? And so I think we finally decided on, you know, keeping it somewhat narrow, but also pointing out other things. And she wrote a little outline up, and so I think she has a presentation for us on that. And what is the committee that you guys meet, Partners for Water Quality, right, which I get emails about all the time, and they're always busy doing a number of things in regards to that, both up the watershed and everywhere else. So I think that you have some good things to tell us about this statewide ordinance and the issues at the county as well, and maybe the city level. All right. Jill, thank you.
Hi. Am I turned on here, I think? Yeah. Hi, I'm Jill Falcone. I'm the stormwater coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo Stormwater Management Program. And I hope I'm not too discouraging to you tonight. We're going to talk about a massive global problem. And no, it's not an economic collapse. It's the marine plastic debris problem. It is a global problem, and it is huge. Maybe most of you probably know about it already. The reason that Matt wanted me to talk about it tonight is that I am working with the IWMA, Bill Worrell, to work on approaches with the county to address this problem. And you heard about that a little bit earlier tonight. But one thing to be able to be effective in approaching that is to take a look at the problem so you can see the scope of it and see the kind of all aspects of it. And we'll take a look at plastic. Then at the top, you'll see the polystyrene pieces and more fragments. The amount of plastics in the oceans is increasing in a staggeringly, exponentially. But when you think back, plastic didn't even exist before 1950. And the amount that is being released into the ocean now is just phenomenal. 80% of it is coming from land, from you and me. It's not coming from ships necessarily dumping it into the ocean. Stormwater runoff carries a lot of it through the creeks into the ocean. And that's why the stormwater management programs are so concerned about trying to stop it at the source. It's very injurious to fish and wildlife, lethal, and you'll see more about that. And it's persistent. Doesn't decay for perhaps 100, maybe even thousands. In some cases, it may not ever decay. And it's thought that it can transport toxic organic pollutants, not to wildlife, but then also as a pollutant in the water. And since it's made from petroleum, it's not. It uses a non-renewable resource that's quite expensive to us. Many of you have heard of the garbage patches in the ocean. And the one here on the off the Pacific Gyra, off the coast of the United States, is the one that you hear about a lot being two times the size of the state of Texas. That one, and then there's another off Japan. These are...
That's
actually pretty good. Yeah. These contain huge amounts of trash, unbelievable amounts of trash, floating around in the ocean. And they swirl around for just as garbage patches. And that can swirl around for years and years, and they are trapped there. And one of the concerns is that you can go 2,000 miles offshore and find, for example, a plastic bag. Like this one. And you can imagine that wildlife would see something like that as perhaps a food. In the case of a sea turtle, they may believe that's a jellyfish, and they would try to eat that and strangle on it. And our newest national monument in Hawaii, this is an actual photograph. This one is near that Pacific Gyra, and virtually tons and tons and tons of this trash that gets trapped in the gyra gets dumped on the shores here on the beach of Camillo Beach here on this particular island. And it's in the newest national monument, and it's just an enormous amount of stuff. And this kind of plastic trash, that is plastic toys, it's plastic lighters, balloons, beverage containers, just all kinds of different things. And coming from Japan, from the United States, again, it's just swirling for decades. And recently, the federal government cut the budget to pick this trash up. So every year, for the last several years, the federal government would try to clean this stuff up every year. Of course, it's redeposited continuously from the gyra, and the budget was recently cut. They can't really keep up with it. But this is the nature of this particular problem, is that you have to continuously work on eliminating this stuff at its source. You can just continuing to try to clean it up is not going to work. And we'll talk more about removing it at the source. But it's a huge, huge problem. This kind of gives you, this is maybe one of the more severe cases of it. They find that the plastic doesn't go away. It photodegrades. It breaks down, not as we might expect it to go away. It just breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces. And this isn't necessarily a good thing because it acts like plankton. What the scientists here have found that on the basis of mass, there's six times more of this plastic than there are plankton. And what happens is that the filter feeders, like the whales, they are ingesting this. And that's causing them great harm as well. So, sure.
I just came from, is this on?
It sounds okay. Like so.
I just came from the Surfrider Regional Conference up in Santa Cruz, and Algalita just did another, they just returned from another tour to the gyre, and the statement at Surfrider was that it's now 30 times more plastic than plankton.
That's really awful.
Which is a 10 years. 10 years ago it was six times, and it's now 30. And that's really new information, so I don't, like don't quote me, but that is what was stated at Surfrider.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit.
30 times more.
Even worse, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Staggering. So to even make that worse, it's believed that plastic transports organic pollutants as well. So in many cases, pre-production plastics, that known as nurdles, make their way to the ocean environment as well. So in places like large metro areas that produce plastics, the pellets that are used in the production environment make their way into the ocean through storm drains typically. These are, keep in mind, when the plastic beverage containers and other types of plastic products were made, they contain plasticizers and other compounds like bisphenol A and phthalates that we don't like to in our bodies very much. But when they get out into the ocean environment, they get ingested by fish and wildlife and creatures out there. Well, if they're not so pleasant in our bodies, the smaller creatures, it's even worse for them as well. Keep in mind these phthalates and other things are endocrine disruptors. And so, again, if they're troublesome for us, larger creatures, they're more so more troublesome even for the smaller creatures. In addition, not only the nurdles, but plastic fragments from the production plastics and the used plastics, they are hydrophobic and they attract contaminants like PCBs that are also out in the environment as well, and hold on to those compounds and can release them later in organisms and also in the aquatic environment. So additional problems with having plastics in the ocean. Give it to me again. Oh, that's what locks it. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Now, to give you an idea of the types of plastics and their sources, the 2007 International Coastal Cleanup results from the Ocean Conservancy give you a pretty good idea. The top 10 debris items that are collected in the 2007 events. The most famous ones, of course, are the cigarette filters from cigarette butts, food containers and wrappers, beverage caps and lids, and then number four, my personal favorite, bags. We'll talk a lot about plastic bags. And then beverage bottles. So bags and bottles are number four and five. And then, again, food items, cups, plastic forks, spoons, things like that. Here's found injured. So on a worldwide basis, that gives you an idea of how severe this problem is. So when you go back to California, this is a kind of an idea of what a California beach can look like. Can anybody guess what beach this is? Is this, do anybody recognize this beach? It's not on the Central Coast.
Is this Long Beach? I was going to say Long Beach.
This is Long Beach, yeah. So this is the type of beach that has to be cleaned twice a day. Yeah, okay, twice a day. So not like our beaches, but good to kind of know that this does happen in California. So let's go closer to home. So this is a newspaper article that came out in 2006. And this is a story from Cambria talking about some stuff from the gyra. These are some fishing gear that has Japanese markings on it. So some gifts from Japan from the gyra that showed up on our beaches here. They showed up on Piedras Blancas all the way down to Morro Strand. And so we do have marine debris showing up on our beaches at times. So here is a report to give you some idea of local conditions here on our beaches. This is from the National Marine Debris Monitoring Program. These are results from our coast cleanup from the years 1996 to 2006. And we have EcoSlow generally has volunteers go out to do these cleanups, and they take a lot of time to actually characterize the trash. It's a lot of effort on their part. And here it's reported back in to a national database. And so here you can see a report specifically for Morro Bay City Beach. And very interestingly, here on the left, you'll see plastic bags reporting very large number, 332 with seams less than 1 millimeter. I'm not sure why they need to know the seam part. And then more plastic bags with the seams greater than 1 millimeter at 46. And then plastic bottles at 218. So again, the big deals here, plastic bags, plastic bottles. So keep that in mind. But you can kind of see balloons are out there too with big numbers and straws. Montano d'Oro, plastic bags, 380 it looks like. And more plastic bags, again with the seams, the big seams at 35. And plastic bottles, 327. And then sort of food bottles, 207. So bottles, bags, and it looks like metal beverages over here too. Now typically beverage containers that are that have CRV, we typically don't see as many of those because people return those. Yes.
The pie charts on there, I'm having a hard time. I think it's land-based, ocean-based, and unknown.
Uh-huh.
I noticed a real difference between, I think our volunteers do that stretch. It's a portion of the sand spit that we do out of the park. See a real difference in terms of the sources of the debris.
Yes.
There versus the more strand where you can have probably exponentially more visitors on a long-term basis when you're closer to the sea.
Right. This one I saw Montano d'Oro also was reporting ocean liner debris too on this one, which Morro City Beach didn't have any of that either. So this one's a little different.
Does that say unknown or general?
General.
General.
Yeah. Sorry, it's not so easy to see.
It's unknown to be with general.
Yeah. So since this is a large global problem, I thought it'd be, you know, illustrative to try to see how other people are handling this and take a look at the categories of approaches. So people try recycling programs, producer take-back programs. You can see approaches to smoking prohibitions to try to get rid of the cigarette butts. Several years now in a plastic bag fee or tax of, it was 15 cents, now it's 22 cents, but it has reduced their bag use by 95%. So they're one of the classic examples. So one of the things here is,
is it okay to ask a question?
Or fee.
Yeah. Is it okay to ask a question?
No.
Oh, okay.
You are
then
banned.
I won't. Sorry.
Ban or tax? No, go ahead. I'm just kidding.
I was just wondering, do we know who the producers are of the bags in those countries? Because I think that it may be the reason we're having such a hard time is we produce a lot of the bags for these other places.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so it's easy for them to ban them because there's not an industry, a domestic industry to do it. I don't know.
Well, I read a story about the Walmart truck lined up and it coming from China, the bags coming from China. So I suspect a lot of the bags are made in China, I'm guessing, but I really don't know for sure. The Plastic Industry Council is really lobbying hard against many of these bans as they're across the in California at least. So they tried. Yeah, we'll talk a little more about that as we get going. So we many approaches. One of the key ideas here. Tax versus ban. Okay, so you saw in the world, across the world, they've been able to tax or ban and been successful. Seattle has recently proposed a 20 cent fee per bag, and San Francisco attempted the fee in 2005. City of LA attempted the ban recently, and County of LA has been studying the ban. You know, we have been following County of LA, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, because that one's very, very critical to us. On a recent bill that just died in the state legislature. Okay. However, on the upside, there have been many polystyrene bans across California, probably 15 or 20 of them, and they are successful and are being upheld. So polystyrene, like the foam cups and things like that, those are holding like that. Those are working out okay. We seem to be able to do those. But we're having trouble with the bags. So it's kind of striking in that it's reported that we have 19 billion plastic bags distributed in California each year, with less than 5% of them being recycled. Okay, so you contrast that to different strategies. In Germany, for example, they have the producer take-back program, and that's where the manufacturers and the selling, the sellers take back the packaging materials. So they have a 75% recycling rate compared to our 5% recycling rate. So different strategies can work in different, different places. We have... now, last year in July, the legislature did pass a bill where supermarkets are did put recycling units in their stores and are encouraging recycling, but yet recycling isn't really taken off all that great still. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more on why aren't the bans and the fees working out very well in California. We all had our hopes up pretty high on AB 2058. And what this was is it offered a fee of 25 cents on each bag. And if you imagine this would be a pretty good disincentive, because if you went to the store and for each bag, it was 25 cents. You'd remember to bring your reusable bag pretty darn quick, right? 25 cents, you know, you wouldn't be taking that many plastic bags. And what it did, though, it had a cap at $2, so it wouldn't have been that oppressive of a situation for the consumer when this bill died. The supporters of this particular bill, you can see LA County wanted it really, really bad. They were one of the big sponsors of the bill, along with Heal the Bay, Sierra Club, Surf Rider, and others. So, and other counties as well, because instead of each jurisdiction, like SLO County, the cities, and everybody trying to do this, by themselves, the hope was is that the state would be able to pass something like this, and you know, we would have it be able to get it statewide. You can see city and county of San Francisco as well. But unfortunately, it didn't make it. One of the reasons, when I ask why is it that the bans weren't making it through, and I was told it was because industry was suing the municipalities on the basis of CEQA lawsuits, because the municipalities weren't doing well enough economic analysis to prove that that their impact of not having the bags was adequate. So there's a cautionary note if we try to go out and do that, that we have to do the economic impact for CEQA. So these are the kinds of problems that have come up in the past for other municipalities trying to ban plastic bags in California. So local approaches for us. Well, first of all, whenever you're trying to make a big change like this, education always has to be first. And for many years now, we have been giving out these reusable plastic bags. We've given thousands and thousands of them out. And we try to remind people to use them, since that's one of the deterrents, is forgetting them in your car or in your house. So the more recently, we add this little reminder tag on here. Keep plastic bags out of the ocean. Keep using me over and over again is a little tag that we keep on there. We also, plastic bottles, of course, are the big deal, too. And so we try to encourage people to use these also. Then, of course, each one of us is the personal change. We have to be the change you want to see. And the agencies themselves have to make the change first. And so I really applaud the city of Morro Bay for stepping up and eliminating the use of the disposable water bottles at their own meetings. And that's something that the county needs to take that step first as well. And then, of course, building the public support before you try to make the ordinance changes. And that's something we need to do. And then hopefully with the help of this group, too, is to get the public support out there. And then, of course, pushing hard for action at also, at the federal, state, and local levels for these for the changes, that legislative changes that need to be made, hopefully at the state levels first, but then if it needs to be at the local level, so be it. We'll have to fight it out and get it that way. So for the stormwater management program, we do have specific requirements. Typically, they are for education. We are required to promote the reusable cloth bags and to promote the elimination of the disposables where we can. We're not specifically required to ban plastic bags or bottles, but that's something that we are going to attempt to do in one form or another. Not sure which is going to work, ban or tax, one way or the other. To promote the plastic recycling in the best way that we can. There are still a lot of issues with plastic recycling. So one thing that we wanted to do is to open it up to this group to ask for your help in an action plan for the MIG to see what steps this group would like to see to support the county in seeking prohibitions for plastic bags, and eventually would seem polystyrene containers as well.
Creatures and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions of Jill? Carolyn.
Yeah, would in considering an action plan, would it be better to start with a very small area and show that it's successful and expand it out, or start with a larger area such as the county or the state and impose it onto the small area? I'm thinking specifically of Port St. Louis and Avila Beach, and it's kind of a contained, isolated, contained area. And when I was first thinking about this issue, it seemed like that would be a good place to start and to show that it's successful, and then you could use that example as in your CEQA documentation to show that it can in fact be successful, and then expand it out into a larger area instead of going start grassroots and move it out instead of going the other direction.
Okay. If you have a relatively isolated area like you do in Avila without a lot of large chain stores that have standardized procedures, you might be able to do that on a voluntary basis.
Possibly.
Whereas large stores probably say they don't want an Albertsons here to be operating totally different from an Albertsons, you know, in Atascadero or something.
Well, I was thinking of the Chambers of Commerce and the business associations, and that those would be good avenues for education and get them to buy into it voluntarily instead of imposing it on them. Perhaps it would be more successful.
Okay. What are some other ideas that people have or other thoughts about? First, I think you maybe to, if we could, to go back to what do you perceive the issue or concern, and maybe some of the folks, you know, I'm thinking, Jeremiah, since you're out on the boat so much and you see a lot of what's happening in the water, and you know, Rick, what's your calibration of this issue of plastics pollution out there, just from your vantage point, since you're kind of seeing it not just at the beach but beyond?
Commercial fishermen are required to keep a log of every bit of trash we have in the boat that we leave the beach with. We have to have a trash log. And one of the things that's always struck us as rather unusual is and we, believe me, are extremely cautious not to let anything go in the water that shouldn't be there. But especially in Southern California, no, not so much here, there's piles and piles of balloons everywhere. Everywhere, big piles. I mean, sometimes you'll try, I don't do it a whole lot anymore, but see, wow, there's something huge and red over there. I better see if it's a raft or something. You go 2 or 3 miles out of your way, and it's a big, giant pile of balloons. And it's apparently legal. I say apparently because these balloons are discharged by big cruise ships. If I discharge a plastic bag, I get a huge fine. But if a cruise ship discharges 2,000 pounds of balloons, it's a party. So I just have always been kind of scratching my head, going, how could this seems to be a disparaging in any case.
Okay, so there's some offshore releases that are even beyond the issue of what could be done on land here, but what's happening out there in a relatively unregulated environment. Are you seeing, how are you dealing with this issue in the harbor area and so on? And what are you observing, Rick?
Well, you know, we're a fairly limited area where we have luckily a lot of volunteer help. But it's a problem. You see it in the ocean. You see it when you're diving. You see plastic bags sometimes underwater. It's a problem. Our lifeguards generally pick up quite a bit of trash every day when they're there in the summer too.
So part of what we're hearing here is it's a very broad base. Some of it's happening right out in the ocean and being released there. Some of it from the shore, and you're observing it in the marine environment in a variety of different contexts. Any other observations about the nature of the problem and how you look at it, Monica?
I'm wondering, in terms of cost to the county, you know, the county is very supportive of cleanup days, cleanup creek days, and beach cleanup, and to the it involved in ways to support those efforts, contributing staff time and equipment and other types of support for those events. And is there any way to equate?
I wanted you to be aware of some other related activities. Once again, I'm Mike Hang. I'm the Erie Hang Resource Protection Coordinator for the sanctuary. But we have been able to secure some funding to address some submerged marine debris issues. You may know that both NOAA Nationwide as well as the Ocean Protection Council have developed marine debris action plans, and there's a strong emphasis on education, on prevention, on reduction of single-use container. But we are also working on submerged marine debris as well, with a focus on debris that is poses risk of entanglement to marine organisms. So lost fishing gear, other types of plastics that may entrap or entangle marine organisms. So we are working in coordination with Cal Department of Fish and Game, who has an effort focused on that, as well as an organization called CDOC, which is based out of UC Davis. And basically, they have been taking, for a while now, they've been focusing on marine debris at kind of diveable depths, down to about 60, 80 feet, something like that. And we anticipate that the sanctuary will partner with them and focus on the deeper depths using surface platforms and possibly some remote operated vehicles and some sniffing devices associated with them to get debris at deeper depths. We're working on trying to identify priority areas to look at. There's some data out there. National Marine Fisheries Service has done some deep sea submersible surveys, and they have been logging and tracking debris that they find. The sanctuary, in partnership with others, have also been doing some underwater camera slit tows and identified some areas of marine debris as well. What we would like to do is to partner with commercial fishermen to help us identify areas of likely either known lost fishing gear or likely areas to look that we could go back and do some additional survey work and prioritize that area. We're also interested in partnering and contracting with commercial fishermen to serve as platforms to help us retrieve that gear, fishing boats that would have appropriate capabilities to operate ROVs and to help collect that gear. So we're looking for opportunities to help get that word out. We're still in the planning stages of that, but hopefully we'll be moving forward on that in the coming calendar year in 2009. Just one other thing real quickly relating to Steve's presentation. I was struck by some of the information that presented that there really are many opportunities for folks to work together to address some of those things. I know since I've arrived and become more familiar with some of the issues here, I'm very motivated to develop better working relationships with the commercial fishing community and also work on economic sustainability of the fishing, the community-based fishing industry in the area. And we're looking for other opportunities for getting together to have discussion and dialogue. One of the things that we've been talking with our Sanctuary Advisory Council is the possibility of forming a commercial fishing working group or something like that, to have a forum where we can explore opportunities to work together on some of these kinds of issues, marine debris and also fishing sustainability, including the possibility of some kind of a certification program. I'm actually exploring that concept with folks within NOAA and the National Fisheries Service about the possibility of moving in that kind of direction of some kind of a sustainable fishing certification that might assist in enhancing the net value and sustainability of the local fishing industry.
Okay. So, any other thoughts about what you'd like to address with regard to this? And I know that PJ had sent, had drafted up something. She was, PJ Webb was one of the persons who was working with Matt and with Mary on this topic, and she had sent around just before the meeting to me a possible statement about this topic. And would you like to read it, Matt, or you want, or Mary?
I haven't had a chance yet to see it, but I'll read it. Okay. I can actually briefly look at it.
Just see whether or not this is would be a helpful statement of the problem or
the
input
second,
into the process.
Second paragraph here. At its meeting, October 22, 2008, the Marine Interest Group of San Luis Obispo County reviewed and discussed the problems associated with plastic waste, including shopping bags and food containers. Disposable plastic products are generally designed for a one-time usage, generating a huge waste stream of materials daily, in addition to the resources used to manufacture and transport this mountain.
The issue from her understanding of it and prior research about it.
Where would the letter go?
I think the letter would probably get addressed to the Board of Supervisors and with a copy to that Integrated Waste Management Association that they're part of, because that's sort of the decision-making body that would be of relevance here. Whether they take that and go on to some other level because they're thinking about, you know, what's happening to the state would be another issue.
Well, I think this seems like one of those issues that the Marine Interest Group historically has found consensus about. I mean, it's the same kind of issue. We're hearing from a variety of people around the table in the group that this is an issue, and so I would support the letter, and I don't know if we need a formal motion of some sort, but I certainly speak in support of moving the letter on to the appropriate people at the county and in other areas like the waste management.
So let's check in and see if there are any alternative approaches to communicating what your interests or concerns might be, or any concerns that you have about the nature of a statement like that from the Marine Interest Group.
So this is going to be a general statement that the Marine Interest Group supports a move away from the single-use plastic.
Right, and defining solutions to that problem.
There's nothing yet specific.
As to whether it's a ban or a tax or if it's some other vehicle, that would be to be determined by others.
Are you calling on us to help create an action plan or to identify specific actions, or is it?
I think it's kind of up to what you want to do.
Just one to interject. One of the things that I was considering, because I didn't have any particular angle on this either, but when we were talking about it, it becomes a place when we know this is happening at the county level and it's and other counties and state level, that through our state connections and various possibly other areas, it's just, I think, a strong message to be sent from a diverse group that this is a populist issue, right? It's not a limited, I think, or a narrow group that is concerned about this, because obviously the state is hearing on one side from a very powerful lobby, and I think that when I think about a local grocer, there may be some cost issue, obviously, in going with plastic, but that's something that could be dealt with. It's the larger chains, as we were talking about before, that would be hard to convince because of the massive quantity they buy with and the lobbying. So I think it would just be good at one level, and I think there are many levels, if we could get behind something that sent a message to county and to state that a variety of people who are in touch with the marine environment and who obviously do lots of other stuff for it at least feel that in the spirit of it, this is the way that what should be looked into. So.
And, you know, you could, if you wish, sort of append to a statement like that, that as broader actions are being contemplated, encourage communities that may choose to adopt the efforts on a voluntary basis to do so, to pick up on Carolyn's idea.
You know, one of the things when I was exploring this earlier on, but not early enough, I found that there's a timeliness issue here too. When companies and restaurants and agencies are doing their budgets, they're budgeting for their order for the summer season. If it's a seasonal kind of community like Avila Beach is, the folks are planning their next summer's inventory, and so we kind of need to begin to talk about it right away so that we can participate with them before they do their budgeting.
Okay. Well, I think this letter, this memo that was written, is a perfect start. I think it's a good thing for our group to endorse and to maybe get a show of hands and just move on from here, realizing that this first attempt isn't the solution. It's just an idea that the interest from MIG is in support of improving this condition, and we'll continue to take activities and do things that can support it on through time. But right now, this is a good way to start our relationship with the Board of Supervisors.
Mm-hmm. Monica, and then if there are any other concerns that we want to hear from the group, or then maybe we draw this to a close.
I just wondered, I think that's a very good comment and observation. This is a good starting point. But in terms of the process, Jill, that you are undertaking to develop an action plan, where, what stage are you at? And is
another bill will come along next session, and we can alert you to that, and then we may want to try to support that and see what happens with the state again.
Okay. Yeah,
is the November 12th, can you elaborate a little bit on the November 12th meeting that Bruce Gibson or mentioned? When you're going to have a county meeting on the ban on November 12th?
I think that's just with IWMA.
Okay.
That's not a supervisor's meeting.
Okay, and there's no open to the public where a MIG representative could attend?
I think they're just scoping at this point.
Okay.
One other question is, you know, where does recycling come into this? Is that still a viable option for eliminating part of the problem, at least? I mean, because I know you can recycle plastic bags at the grocery store. As far as I know, that's the only place that actually takes those in quantity. Perhaps if there were places around the city, around the community, that would take plastic waste specifically, and I don't know what that means in costs, but I would think that recycling is also something that we should certainly investigate until we do eliminate the plastic, at least get it back to the right place instead of out in the ocean.
Yeah, they will keep recycling as well.
Okay. Sally, from Assembly Member Blakesley's office.
I thought I would just address the group.
I think you need to just turn on the microphone.
Okay. I thought I'd just give a state legislature perspective on the bill that Joe brought up 2 weeks ago, which is that it began in the Assembly and actually passed through the committee process there and was approved by the Assembly and then moved to the Senate where it wasn't being hearing And I thought I'd just give you some of the opposition that I heard. I was following it with a lot of interest. And some of the opposition that I heard of was one, you're always going to have legislators that are going to be against some kind of extra fee or some kind of extra regulation that's difficult for some legislators. Another was that the tax is considered to be regressive, meaning that it disproportionately affects people with low income, which I always thought was not a very great argument because, as we know, you don't have a lot of money, you get smart, you get creative, and bring your cost back. And the third argument I heard was to wait and see. And Jill had mentioned the bill that was passed in the previous year about the intro recycling at the grocery stores and pharmacies. Some legislators said, let's see what our recycling program is doing. And another bill that was passed the previous year was one that mandated large grocery stores and pharmacies to have the 99-cent PVC bags and kind of reusable bags at the door. So those large companies are now required to sell those bags for 99 cents. So some other legislators said, let's make, you know, those pan out and see if our, you know, the effect of the lettering down. And I think you're definitely right that the bill will probably represent again this next question. And I also think that as a group like yourself, any letter that you send to legislators is very helpful to a preliminary position. And as opposed to the fee versus the ban, the fee, I think, has a better argument when Matt was saying about imposing costs for for small grocers because they don't then have to impose a new cost to get a higher tax bag or something like that. So I think that was one of their arguments for the fees.
Thank you. So what's the will of the group? Are people generally in favor of going forward with a statement such as the one that Matt read with maybe some notations about, you know, encouraging, looking for demonstration opportunities, and enhancing recycling efforts as broader initiatives are pursued to address the problem, make sure we're taking advantage of interim steps to try to do something on a voluntary basis to improve the circumstances. Is that the gist of the group?
It certainly is mine, but I haven't seen it yet, and I'm always loath to pass things that I haven't read. Suggest that maybe it sounded like PJ sent it to everyone. I'm not sure.
She sent it to me late in the day, okay. And I didn't know, what the intention was from the group that was putting it together. So
my vote would be that we go forward with it pending a sort of round of email revisions and circulations until no one else has anything more to add to it. I think there are probably, I haven't seen that there may be some things or two to add about encouraging recycling, other approaches, and I certainly think anything like this we send should get CC'd to our state and our federal representatives because, mm-hmm. frankly, I think it's...
Offer other recommendations, and we'll bring that to closure and get it out to the state, federal, and local officials. Okay. Good. So we've got a couple brief items remaining here. Actually, there's three. One, there was interest expressed last time about the oyster mariculture, what's happening with it. There's a brief update about slow sea. And then this is our concluding workshop meeting for the Marine Interest Group for 2008. And I need to take just a few minutes of your time to get what your interest would be for 2009, as we need to then go out and see what the opportunities are to get support for that and be able to have the resources to carry the group forward. So, Dan, did you have something as a brief report on the oysters?
Yeah, and it is very brief, which is probably good given the hour. The short version is that over the course of last spring and summer, there was an additional area of the shellfish leases that was closed, classified as changed from an approved or conditionally approved to prohibited, which was a major disruption to the oyster operations because they had to literally pick up and move I don't know how many thousands of pounds of oysters and gear out in the bay. They have been having good water results for the last couple months. They've been harvesting a lot of oysters. They have a lot of oysters out there. This is primarily the Tomales Bay Oyster Company. So they're feeling a little bit of a sigh of relief right now. I have a map, but I won't bother to run over and get it up there. I can distribute it around. I think of the total lease areas in the bay, I mean, just looking at the map, it's, we've gone from, maybe 50% of them being open to harvesting. Now it looks more like 30%. I'm guessing, but 60 to 70% of the area that's, classified as oyster growing is now prohibited due to bacteria levels. There was a real effort over the summer that we were involved in we put together a proposal to really expand the monitoring of bacteria levels out there. We were anticipating some funding to do that didn't come through yet but may come through eventually. One of the frustrating things about it is that once an area is closed, there tends not to be any more monitoring there. But you need that monitoring to make the case that it's safe to reopen it. So some of the areas that are prohibited have been prohibited for years, and we actually don't know. They may be clean enough to open up again, but the onus is on the growers to do the testing, and it's pretty expensive to do the testing on an ongoing basis. We put together about a $20,000 budget to basically restart sampling at a lot of sites that have been sampled historically and are no longer being sampled. The oyster growers have on their own picked up a handful of sites as sort of a backup plan to say, wow, if we get closed again, we may need to move again. And so the asteroid program is still working to try and find the funding to expand some of the bacteria monitoring out there. So the oyster operation, they're rolling, but they're sort of the area keeps shrinking. And it's they're definitely feeling sort of threatened that if it continues to get worse, they're not quite sure. And the underlying issue of what's driving the bacteria continues to be You know, the best answer we have is there's a bunch of different sources. It's almost impossible to tell. You know, you get a high bacteria number, you don't know if it's the sea lions or the birds or somebody not picking up after their pets or boaters or low-so-so septic tanks. All these things have been implicated. They're probably all contributing, and it's almost impossible scientifically to answer the question. So, you know, from our perspective, the best approach is to go after all the sources that there's a way to try and control. And so we're working with folks to do that. The only other maybe hopeful thing is that the area that got closed is the area most adjacent to the state park marina. The state parks put quite a lot of resources after many years this last spring into upgrading some of the sewage station components of the sewer system down there. There's a lift station that's sort of immediately adjacent to the bay that was very old. This is part of to pump the sewage from the Morro Bay State Park campground area back up the hill over into the city to get it into the city's wastewater plant. There's some hope that maybe that upgrade of replacing the lift station and relining those lines, maybe that was a source. State Park says it wasn't. I don't know if it'd be, you know, hopefully it wasn't, but hopefully things will get better. So I'm not sure. I don't think it's been clearly established whether it's a source or not, but it's definitely an area that people are concerned about and one thing that's been addressed. So we're hoping that maybe we'll see some better.
And we converted that to a proposal. And we've heard back on about, well, we have multiple funders, but we've heard back on about 50% of the budget is funded. And so that's good. And over the course of the next several months, we're continuing to work with other interested parties that are showing interest, and we hope that over the next several months we'll fill out the rest of that budget. So I think that's probably the most important and pertinent thing to say, and also just to thank the Marine Interest Group, because this stakeholders group is really important to SLOC, and it provides a connection to the community and to the broader marine interests that links my organization and our organization to the community. And so it's really important for us that this group stay active. And you've been very good at supporting the work that we've done, and we've been able to get some real management action out of letters like the one that we're endorsed tonight from this group. So it's been very important to us. So thanks for the Marine Interest Group support, and I'm happy to say we're going to be around.
Good. I just comment that I've had an opportunity through SLOC to talk with people in other parts of the West Coast that are working on ecosystem management and similar sorts of issues. And I'm always struck by how often this area is looked at as the model, and along with the kinds of things that Henry is doing with the Nature Conservancy and Environmental Defense and the commercial fishermen to do the community-based fishing associations and so on, people are really recognizing that this is the area in the entire West Coast that is a leader in innovation. And so that always is a challenge, because that means we're sort of blazing the trail, but it also means that there's a lot of interest and attention for what we're doing, and that creates a great opportunity for us to attract more resources to the area and it to be a demonstration for others, which helps us in attracting resources to do what's right here for the community. So that's a great opportunity for us. So I just need to round out here with a discussion with you and need your best thinking for a few more minutes on what are some of the thoughts that you have for the Marine Interest Group in 2009 as we need to plan out what that program looks like, what kinds of things, what sort of activities, you don't have to specify the specific topics, but what kinds of things, what role do you see for the Marine Interest Group in that time frame, and then how do you see going about it? You know, we worked through three meetings this year with some communications in between via email and so on. So I'm interested in knowing what kind of role or roles are you interested in the Marine Interest Group playing in 2009, and then what are some of your thoughts about how it might do that? This would then translate into our looking at, okay, how do we scope a program and a set of activities? So in terms of the what or the roles, what might come to mind?
Well, I think we just need to re-endorse exactly what we just heard from Dean, that we need to make SLOC one of our very highest priorities and find ways of hearing the feedback on a regular basis on the success that you are willing to share with us.
Okay. What are some other...
John, I think, you know, Henry? Based on or as using the discussion that was generated from Steve Scheiblauer's presentation today, I think the Marine Interest Group can continue to play a role, a liaison between the community and the commercial fishing industry, and provide support and a mouthpiece for some of these facts that are tend to be muddled or difficult to uncover. I think one of the ways we can do that is to support the programs that are going on here, that collaborative programs that are going on here in the commercial fishing industry, and collaborative programs that are going on elsewhere.
Okay. What are some other thoughts? Mary?
To do ongoing support for the one-time use plastics bans that the county is working on.
Mm-hmm.
That should be advocacy role.
Okay. An advocacy role.
So advocacy around water quality, one example of which is the plastic debris.
I would separate the two issues because they're both quite substantial, or water quality and plastics.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm not getting specific, but just being...
Because it seems like our support matters in some circles. That's what we think, and I think it shows. And so I think to show that on at least our website would benefit our cause, but would also draw people towards us with issues that then may become something that we care about. And it'll
sure. So make it kind of a two-way thing where people
yeah.
could post issues or concerns they'd like to bring to the attention of the Marine Interest Group, and maybe this could be a sorting place for those issues and give them some attention. It could be a two-way approach. I'm glad that you brought up the website, because one of the things that happened is we were very much the beneficiaries of the generosity of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program and their willingness to have MIG exist as an offshoot of their website. They went through a restructuring of their website, and so now we kind of need to think where we go with that. I know that SLOC had offered to have it as an offshoot off of its website, and that would be maintained by Cal Poly. And I don't know if Dean, your resources are available to do that. I think we want to check in. Would that be okay with people? But it doesn't make sense.
Cal Poly can host the website for the MIG, and it would have its own. We would give it its own site, but it would also be. You could link through the estuary program to it. You could link through SLOC, Surfrider's website. You know, Lisa Wise Consulting, wherever. I think we would be able to do that, but I think this is really a decision of the group, because the group is, you know, we want to make sure that represents the interests of the group, and we don't turn this into the Cal Poly program or something.
Yeah, I think it'd be important for it to have its own character, but the just the mechanics of it could happen from there. I don't know, Dan, we had talked a little bit about this some time ago. Did you have some further thoughts about that?
No, I'll go back. I need to do some homework with the folks who redesigned our website and think about what it would – I think the way it's set up now and the way we changed our website, there's some challenges with keeping it updated.
Yeah, that was
the
problem. We couldn't update it, so we had to think about moving it somewhere.
Right. So it may be possible that we can keep it and maybe easier, just as easy to have it go there. I was going to speak to the bigger question of roles and how I think I don't have cable, so I don't see it, but I think people watch this at home, I hope. Hello over there. And so I think we have a really valuable role to play in bringing presentations, both to educate ourselves and each other, but also to bring presentations and new information and perspectives to the local community that can watch this easily at home or on the web. You know, and I think Steve's was a great example of that. I think there's been a long history of that with the MIG of bringing information to not just us but to the community. So I think that's a really important role and something we should all think about just as individual organizations, that this is a forum, and, you know, think about how best to do that so that they're really effective. And, you know, I think maybe this particular venue, I was thinking today, we were having trouble, I think, getting the presentations in a format that looked good at home as well as here. And so making sure that we are really conscious of that aspect of our meetings, that this is an opportunity for folks at home to see, to find out something new and hear an informed discussion about local marine interests, and making sure we maximize that value.
And as we update the website, there's also opportunities for us to put a PDF file of the slides from the presentations up there so that people could look at those at their leisure in more detail and make that a more robust resource for them. So there's a variety of ways we can work with that. Janice.
Well, and you can watch these meetings on the web now, too, so that's an advantage. The other thing that I was thinking of, too, though, especially after the presentation tonight, and I don't know who would do this, I'm not volunteering, but press releases that would go out after a meeting like this, saying, you know, this is what we talked about, these are some of the things that we're looking at in the future. I think that there's some really valuable information that came out tonight that a press release would at least alert the community to what goes on here.
To add to that, press releases that happen beforehand so people could come and participate and see the presentations.
Yeah, we do send out the notices for the meetings to all the media. I understand that some of the media now, because it is being broadcast live, sit at home and watch the meeting from home and write and do their tracking of it. So we've gone virtual to virtual. But yes, I hear that what you want to do is make sure that people are aware of this and they're getting the information from it and that it's being a value to the larger community.
Well, and I think if we do a reminder after the meeting to the media of, you know,
it's taking a picture of the screen.
Right. Exactly.
And so that would be a way that we could do it. But you're right. That would mean we'd need to do more advanced coordination with our presenters to get them those files and
well,
do some additional things.
Well, not necessarily.
Things.
I mean, I attend those hearings, and it seems to go pretty smoothly.
Even on the fly.
Yeah.
Okay. Something for us to check
good.
Out.
You know, because I've seen, for example, people walk in with for public comment with PowerPoints, and Steve seems to be able to handle it really well. So,
my
suggestion, another suggestion that I would like to propose is, being new tonight, but certainly I'm aware of the MIG and the work they've done, and I believe that you all were very supportive of the MLPA regional stakeholder process and had contributed to that effort and to the successful implementation of this South Central Coast region. And I would like to propose that the group continue to follow implementation and opportunities that may be developing through the efforts, coordinated efforts of, for example, today we heard from Dennis Long, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, that they are in the process of developing a very active series of phases of education and outreach, some of which is going to be generating materials which they will want to make available to groups. I know in November they're holding a Train the Trainers session, a two-day event that will begin to prepare folks who have the opportunity to conduct specific outreach on the marine environment, whether it's location-related, like Point Lobos, or They've also targeted places like the Natural History Museum here. But I think it would be important for us to stay informed on that effort and link in with that effort. As those opportunities develop, we might consider bringing Rita Bonsell from the Sanctuary Outreach Initiative to come in and talk with us about it, because I will tell you, we're not as represented as we should be right now in their program. And it's, you know, well-funded, Packard, RLFF, the same support that we're all getting in some way from for the coastal programs. And I would like to see San Luis Obispo benefit and mm-hmm. have more visibility in that. So that would be my thought.
Okay. All right. So relative to how the group functions for the coming year, because this also factors into sort of the resources to support it and so on, we worked on a model this year of three meetings, you know, something around the late January time period to sort of catch things after the new year had started up, something in the spring before the everyone goes off for summer vacation and the fishermen go out to sea, and then something sort of after the season, if you will. Does that sort of format work, or do you think more or less? Do you have any particular reactions to that? So that's a working format, and so in terms of the character and style of the meetings and so on, that's what you're looking for. Anything else that you'd have as requests or modifications to how the group functions going forward? I'll jot these up into sort of an outline. I'll send that out also to you in an email, so if you have more thoughts about what would be useful, and there's some members who wanted to be here tonight but couldn't because of family emergencies or other things, give them a chance to input on that as well. But anything that anyone would like to offer at the moment before we close?
I'd like to thank Don for not only what he does, but how he does it. I think you've done a really great job, and you've made it much more satisfying experience for me, and I think for the whole group. So thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you all very much. Well, that's very kind. Thank you. It's my pleasure. You're doing great work, and it's wonderful to be supporting you, and look forward to getting these notes out to you so that you'll see what's next and your further ideas, and we'll be tuning in shortly after the new year with our next formal public meeting, but we can work on things in between. So thanks for coming out tonight, and thank you, our audience, for watching this evening.